Trade flows with DP World. Our global team of 100,000 plus across 73 countries is reshaping supply chains by integrating infrastructure, tech, and local expertise from the factory floor to our customer's door.
You're listening to The Lodestar, the supply chain and logistics industry's leading source of insight. This podcast was created and produced by MK and Associates and your host, Mike King.
The dust has now settled on some huge March trade shows, but if you've been stuck behind your desk feeling sorry for yourself, fear not, because we've got you covered. Not least because I'm joined today by two jet setters who've been moving and schmoozing on your behalf. How selfless of them. Of course, it's the Lodestar's Alex Linnane and Zenitor's Peter Sand, and we're discussing and analysing all major supply chain trends and stories. And honestly, they just keep breaking right now, don't they? We're also delving today into DP World's ambitious logistics strategy in the wake of some rather rapid footprint expansion. I'll be joined later by DP World US and Mexico CEO. It's Glenn Clark.
At DP World, we just announced the opening of over 100 freight forwarding branches. So from the perspective of what the market needs, we're able to now start offering these type of logistics solutions coupled with the investments that DP World's made into contract logistics, into market access, and into the providing, I'll say, the infrastructure of the ports and terminals and economic zones. That's what we're really seeing as our shift and our focus to help provide more solutions to customers in this area.
Hello, everybody. I'm Mike King. Welcome to the Lodestar podcast. If you're a Lodestar podcast virgin and you've missed me blathering on about housework inanely in the past, then do not fret because repetition is my middle name. You can find this podcast wherever you like to listen to content, unless, of course, you like to listen somewhere without podcasts, in which case, a few ideas for you. Give Spotify, Amazon, Audible, or Apple a try. Even better, subscribe to receive each episode direct to your inbox at thelodestar.com. What could be easier? And you'll get the best supply chain news available while you're at it. With no further ado, we have two returning heroes on the Lodestar podcast today, both, I'm sure, overflowing with enthusiasm and news after attending the biggest trade show so far this year. First up is Zenitor Chief Analyst Peter Sand, a star speaker at TPM 24 earlier this month in Long Beach, I hear. How goes it, Peter?
Goes very well, thank you, Mike. Good to be back.
Great to have you. And he is joined today by Alex Linnane, Lodestar publisher, no less. How are you doing, Alex?
Good, thank you, Mike.
Alex, to you first. We've discussed previous incarnations of IATA's World Cargo Symposium on this podcast with varying degrees of disappointment or confusion, perhaps. This year's soiree was held in March in a destination formerly known for its business dynamism, free speech and press freedoms, if I may put it like that. How was IATA World Cargo Symposium Hong Kong? And in fact, how's Hong Kong?
Oh, I've missed it so much. What a fantastic city it is. And, you know, despite everything, Hong Kong really wanted to show itself off as sort of back in the game. Obviously, a lot of people were talking about what it was like in Hong Kong during COVID. Even the exhibition hall we were in, actually, was a temporary hospital and quarantine centre, I believe. And then you look at things like the skyscrapers near the airport and you get this horrible, real sense of how hard COVID must have been. I'm quite an outdoorsy kind of person. It gives me the shudders to think of being shut up in a flat on the 14th floor or whatever. It sort of breaks your heart. And then there, of course, the businesses in our sphere. I met a couple of cafe pilots in a bar, as you do, and it was a really hard time. But Cathay announced its results last week and the pilots got a profit share. And everyone felt, you know, you could feel that things are on the up.
It seems an awful lot of business has been moving to Singapore and in that area of the world, and which is very sad for Hong Kong because I love it myself.
It is sad for Hong Kong. I mean, I think Hong Kongers in general, when I spoke to them, they were quite quick to brush aside concerns over the new security law. But the very fact is that tens of thousands of people have left Hong Kong. But then, to be fair, lots of people have come to Hong Kong as well, mostly from the Chinese mainland. So I imagine there'll be a slight cultural shift in that sense. But Hong Kong still seems very proud of its past. And it has that sense of really wanting to be dynamic again. And I believe it probably is. You can feel a far greater connection to the mainland than you did in the past, and the Pearl River Delta. And there's logistics links that are much stronger there now, and you can feel the pull of the mainland more than you could. But it also feels very modern. I mean, there were robots in restaurants, which totally threw me. There's a lot of more new technology. You've got Kainiao's smart hub there. One weird thing, though, was that you actually need cash in Hong Kong. It's all this modern technology, and yet you don't seem to be able to use your card as much as you'd want. So that threw me for a bit as well. But Hong Kong companies feel very keen to retain their dominance in logistics and their cultural feel that's different from the mainland, and to look after their staff and retain their staff. I took a tour around Haxor, Hong Kong's cargo terminal, and it was amazing. It was basically a sustainability company. It puts people first, which does a bit of cargo handling on the side. And if most companies had even a fraction of whatever they're taking at Haxor, the world would be a much, much better place.
Well, well done, Haxor. It sounds fascinating. That's Hong Kong's one of my favourite airports, I have to say. Probably only up there with Changi for somewhere you might want to while away a few hours, or actually go and see some cargo hubs or some of the cargo operators. Fascinating place. How was the conference itself? We've been slightly sceptical in the past about how serious IATA takes cargo. Did Hong Kong change your mind at all, Alex?
I have to admit, I remain sceptical. I did have an opportunity to grab Willie Walsh at the first evening's reception, which I think surprised him a little bit. No one was really talking to him. And I asked him whether IATA Cargo really was working seriously on behalf of the cargo industry. He said that the very fact that IATA had put on WCS shows how much it cared. And IATA emphasised again and again that it was its biggest ever show, including in passengers. But all that really said to me, a cynic that I may be, was how much money it must have paid from the event. Whether it really cares about cargo is still something of a moot point. I did ask about why we don't see IATA people in the market anymore or at any other shows. And Willie Walsh said they didn't need to be there because they were at WCS. I don't know. I'm not convinced. And to be honest, neither is the market. You'll need to follow thelodestar.com over the next week or so to find out how people are beginning to circumnavigate IATA and therefore how much relevance it will hold in the future.
So it's going to hold less, presumably, is where we're going with these stories.
I would say so, but I need to check a few things. But yeah, I would say that people are starting to see it as much less relevant than it used to be.
Watch this space or watch lodestar.com. And just to clarify there, Willie Walsh is the Director General of the International Air Transport Association, IATA. Sustainability, Alex, that was thrust to the fore as a quote, a must, not an option by IATA. Any takeaways about progress in this area from the conference?
Well, in fact, someone this morning sent me a, talking about IATA and its love for cargo or not, sent me some stats that IATA just published saying that air cargo should really source its game and its emissions are too high, which was a totally bizarre thing to see from IATA. But I think the main takeaway from the conference is that everyone knows it's very important, but still no one knows how to achieve it. I mean, for me, one bit of cognitive dissonance is that the air cargo industry is currently being propped up by flying £2 T-shirts, $2 T-shirts across the world. And that doesn't feel even remotely economically sustainable, let alone environmentally. The focus on sustainability was great, but as yet, not really any answers.
Any sort of sign that we've got a bit more SAF coming down the pipeline? That's the only way we're really going to start making a really big leap towards net zero, right?
That's pretty much what everyone agreed. It has to be SAF. There was one interesting bit on that. According to IATA, $800 billion in investment went into oil and gas last year. Now, just 19% of that would satisfy the need for SAF. So essentially, what they're saying is the energy companies are letting the side down quite substantially. They only need $150 billion to get the SAF it needs. But when you're spending, you know, $800 billion, you think you might be able to fight. It's almost like spare change down the back of the sofa for the oil and gas companies.
Peter, how was TPM24? Or maybe as we've had so much positivity about the event on this podcast previously, what did you learn that you didn't know already? In fact, is what you don't know even a category of information? Was it a good show?
I learn something new every day, Mike. So being at TPM was also on that account a good thing. If I am to add a bit more into that category, it may be that off the beaten track, gems can be found too. So you may wander away from the big halls and find yourself in the speaker's room, and all of a sudden, Peter Tushwell and Otto Schacht shows up, and you have an insightful conversation as far away from the melting crowd as you can possibly get. But I think that's just the opportunity that you should take once it shows up. So I had a lot of good connections at TPM. Sinetta as such, also meeting lots of already existing customers and new prospects. And we brought the Ocean Monitor 2.0, a real, say, adventure for us to, say, launch that product right now and throughout 2024, basically.
Congratulations on the new product. I'm sure Lodestar's covered that in depth. Peter, at TPM 24, you spoke there about how surplus capacity and weak demand will extend the Asia-Europe trade's transition to normalization. Even since your talk, we've had more spot rate declines on that westbound trade to Europe, even though most ships are avoiding Suez and heading around the Cape. What's happening there? Is this about services settling down to longer transits, or is this all about weak European demand and excess capacity?
I think it's both. At first, I think the header was settled somewhat half a year ago. So it was carved in a completely different environment. But without doubt, I mean, being at arguably the most interesting trade lane focus session this year, again, last year it was transatlantic, this year it was Asia to Europe, where what is going on in terms of disruption in Red Sea is affecting the entirety of the business, including Transpac, US Coast, as well as East Coast, right? But getting back to basically what's going on in the market right now, I would say that a huge part of this difference in knowing what's going on has leveled out somewhat. I call it information asymmetry. I mean, the carriers, they have a plan for how to, say, make up for the longer voyages by adding more ships. But you as a shipper may not know what they are doing. You as a freight forwarder also are left in the dark on how does this affect the schedules and the services that I have already sold to my customers. And in the end, you should of course also check Sinetta's blog post where we deep dive into some of the specific numbers behind, you can say, the miraculous escape from Asia to Europe, where you see more or less unchanged levels of weekly capacity offered to shippers out there. But of course, what is not showing up is the amount of ships that is now being fed into the service to uphold that, right? So I think that's really exciting to get your head around those numbers that reveals so much and yet so little. So of course, getting back to you, Mike, getting back to where this rant all started, right? Asia to Europe, Asia to Med. Spot rates have come down since mid-January as compared to those heading to North America that peaked in early February and have come down ever since to the extent of some 20 to 30% on spot rate levels right now. And of course, the long-term market, you may see that as a little bit more lethargic at the moment, where few contracts are signed. Those contracts that are signed are done kind of like twofold, where you have like an existing normal contract where you deal with all the service requirements that you have. And the element on top of that is Red Sea disruption surcharge, right? The one element that you as a shipper hate to pay, but I mean, you've got to pay something in order to make up for the opportunity cost that carriers have from deploying much more capacity into upholding the weekly services out of Asia, right? So what we see in terms of long-term is that they went up in January and they have come down a bit in February. And if you look at it from a little bit of a more trend basis, they may actually start following the spot rates now down again, at least if you look at base rate only. Of course, you cannot really do that. It's all-inclusive all the time, right? But if you take the elements apart, freight forwarders and shippers are pushing yet again for longer-term contracts to basically reflect the gravity of the market overcapacity.
As you mentioned, Peter, the Red Sea crisis has affected a lot of those global container trades. As we record this, various sources are indicating that China and Russia may have struck a deal with the Houthis. What this means and how reliable it would be given the randomness of previous attacks, these are total unknowns as we record this on 22nd of March. But if this is correct for container markets, What are the implications of what I guess then becomes a two-speed container shipping market with speed being the operative word, essentially? It could really favor those Chinese carriers, Costco or OCL.
I think in general, adding uncertainty to the market like this is doing is benefiting the carriers. As alluded to before, they really benefited from massive uncertainty from mid-December to mid-Jan, right? And ever since then, we have seen rates coming down. To me, an agreement, whatever form it may be set in, this doesn't change a lot, right? We've seen Costco and OCL go around Cape of Good Hope, like basically all other major line for 3 months now. So will it matter at all that they now have some sort of an agreement? I'm not so sure. I mean, it's been something that we've known in the corridors all along, that they are seen as allies of the Houthis, at least to some extent, right? But we also saw back in January that one rocket was getting dangerous close to a tanker carrying Russian oil, right? So the fact that the Houthis are in the know of everything they do may just be, say, overstating it a bit. And that will probably also be my conclusion on this. And we can only overstate the importance of this because it may not mean a lot in the end. But time will tell, as you will allude to also, Mike. 2 weeks from now, we may see Costco and OOCL back to Gulf of Aden and Red Sea transits, but I don't think so.
Be a huge competitive advantage if they did, wouldn't it?
Definitely. And we have seen the effects on that, what it can hand a carrier if one is doing that. CMA CGM was the lowest offer in town on that trade for the entirety of January, right? They were quoting $4,000 on the spot markets, where others were chasing $5,500. So, of course, an advice to shippers, keep your eyes out. You may see some carriers all of a sudden dropping spot rates faster than any other because they are heading back to the Suez Canal.
Where are we on those Trans-Pacific contract negotiations, Peter? I mean, obviously, this all factors into that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it factors into this at large, for sure, because, of course, everything is connected in the global world of container shipping networks. And we did also see an effect on the spot market into North America. But the effect on long-term rates have not been at least materializing itself in US dollars and cents to a large extent. What we have seen mainly, of course, there are large shippers out there that cannot just go 100% into the short market. They need constant rolling of volumes on the long-term market also. So what they've done is, of course, manage this risk with the contracts with a shorter duration, right? They have been more selective on where do I need cargo to move and sign contracts only on those trades, right? But taking the benefit of the doubt here, not bringing yourself into a situation where you have to sign at too high level, too high a long-term rate, right? Locking yourself in for a foreseeable future that is likely to bring around increased downward pressure on rates, right? So that's why I also alluded to before, we see contracts that are signed come in the form of basically a two-element deal, where the one element is the one that that is negotiating the most hard right now, the base rate of it all, with the surcharges relating to Red Sea transits being more or less stabilized at the moment, as shippers kind of understand the fact that there is added cost to setting up a supply chain around Cape of Good Hope. And it goes also for the transits into not only U.S. East Coast, of course, but also U.S. West Coast. There are knock-on effects, but fairly flat moving right now. But volatility, I would say, behind the scenes.
There's a lot of jostling going on, and time's a key element in when you might sign these long-term contracts on the Trans-Pacific. Not least, it's not just that playoff between spot rates and contract rates and who's going to settle where. We've also got quite a few things coming up down that pipeline. We've had Panama Canal, low water, not a huge factor for container markets in the end. We've got union action possibly at US East Coast ports later this year. And we've got a new spanner in the works. Now, if you were thinking about maybe signing an annual contract in May or June or something, this would definitely be a factor, because former President Trump has threatened to impose a universal baseline tariff of 10% on all imported goods, and tariffs of more than 60% on imports of Chinese goods if he wins the US election in November. What does this mean for importers? Should they bring their cargo in early? Are they already? Do you account for this in your shipping contract? Is this trading Armageddon if it all happens?
What we saw with the 2018 implementation of higher tariffs from the original trade war, you might argue, or at least the most recent, say, outburst of geopolitical obstacles being set up, was shippers front-loading. So they really got more cargo on the way before actually coming into force. And then it all got a part of the normal way where they paid for it and the American consumers paid for it, not the Chinese. So I guess the whole concept and how you articulate that can be, well, produced in so many different and wrong ways. But in the end, I mean, trade will find a way, just like water. We will not see a huge, say, reshoring, nearshoring, friendshoring effect or wave from this. But by all means, setting up barriers to trade is no good. No good whatsoever. I mean, if you're about to deploy ships you call Prosperity Guardian in Red Sea, right? Why don't you say guard the prosperity of your own people by tearing down terrorist walls instead, Mr. Trump?
Strong words from Peter Sand there. On a related issue, Peter, you've been quite outspoken about these high numbers of box imports coming into Mexico from China. Is this all tie in together? Is this about tariff avoidance, do you think?
I think there's no beating around the bush that Mexican consumers may be really happy, but not that happy. So I call it a backdoor, call it, say, a way of getting boxes into US. It may come in many forms. It may also be a sign of times where shippers have, over the past year, they have also seen China to Mexico imports go up by 35%, according to CTS, right? So they learned that this is a viable corridor when there are obstacles for bringing in goods via US West Coast. We may see if US East Coast and the labor problems on the US East Coast really obstructs imports on that coast, then you will not see all boxes moved in via US West Coast. You will see them also going via Mexico to a large extent. Canada seems not really to be a big volume opportunity, but via Lázaro Cárdenas or Manzanillo on the Mexican Pacific coast, you can rail it, you can truck it, and it seems as if they have the capacity to bring in a lot of boxes via Mexico into the US. We did see also, getting back to one of the candidates for the upcoming election in US for the presidency, right, targeting automotive imports also from Mexico. A lot of automotive elements is also being transported in containers. So there's merit to it. And it's definitely one of those trades that we will follow closely at Senate. If I may just conclude here, I mean, when you have a fast-growing trade like China to Mexico, a trade that is also pretty immature, you see spot rates moving nervously. You see them with more volatility and actually going more narrowly into the spot rates as we cook them on our, or basically crowdsource them on our platform, right? I actually saw spot rates jump into Mexico in the later part of last year, and then they started to slide in January when a lot of boxes got moved in. Of course, there's a little bit of, say, time sensitivity around this, but it's not exact match where demand goes up and rate goes up. It may just be a combination of so many other factors like deployed capacity from main carriers into some of these ports.
It'll be interesting to see how all that develops. As you say, Trump's also threatened tariffs on Chinese manufacturers producing cars, the US market in Mexico. It all feels a bit whack-a-mole. And if you throw in that Canadian imports from China are also soaring as well, what's next on this agenda? But we'll come back to that in later podcasts. Okay, let's pivot away from, shall we, from geopolitics. And let's get back to some market information. Alex, how are those air cargo markets doing? How are things looking post-Lunar New Year?
Well, slightly better than anticipated. People at WCS were quietly pleased with the market in the first quarter. Many said that they were sort of happy things are normalising and that they could cope with a soft Q2 and soft Q3 because Q1 had been okay. And if we're normalising, then Q4 should be good. But as I sort of said before, there's a lot of this is based on e-commerce, and I worry that e-commerce is a bit of a hill of sand, and there are some questions for it to answer about its sustainability.
Sustainability in terms of demand or sustainability in terms of environmental impact?
In terms of demand and environmental impact, actually, yeah.
the question mark being that if we've got, I think your story said it was, there's a tsunami of e-commerce growth, but you're skeptical about how long this lasts.
Well, the thing is, IATA's warning that there's a tsunami of e-commerce is expected. And for that, the industry needs to get all its processes and infrastructure into place, which, you know, it should. We are actually about to launch a short series on e-commerce on the Lodestar. And my gut feeling is that there are some issues coming up which could affect volumes. I don't know if you saw that last week the French have imposed a tax on fast fashion. There's growing concern about environmental sustainability. But I also think there are some other concerns, as I said before, economic sustainability. Does it really make sense to deliver, but to fly a $2 T-shirt? And there's, what was it, the EU is concerned about data sharing from some of the e-commerce platforms. There's concern about dangerous goods. There's an awful lot of stuff coming up, which I think the airlines should start to look into. And the thing with air cargo is it always moves fairly swiftly from one hit commodity to the next, whether it used to be iPhones, then it's vaccines, now it's e-commerce. And ultimately, a lot of stuff ends up finding its way back to sea freight again. And there'll be another next big thing in air cargo, in my opinion.
We've seen on the air cargo front some big numbers out of the likes of Colombo Airport, Bangkok. Dubai throughput was running at more than 150% up at times this month compared to a year earlier. Is this tsunami of e-commerce, or is this sea air shipments due to container shipping diversion? What's going on?
I suspect it's a mixture of both. From the forwarders I've spoken to, forwarders want us to tell their customers what's going on in the market just in case their customers don't quite believe them. So several forwarders have got in touch to say, we think that rates out of, say, India, Colombo are going to continue going up. A lot of this is garments, actually, rather than just pure e-commerce. So it's the traditional garment makers as well, which are doing that to avoid the disruption in sea freight. I think it's the Red Sea diversions are putting stuff on air. But I think it's a lot of charters. It's a mixture of stuff. I mean, Colombo is way more busy than people were expecting. I was talking to someone there last week and they were saying that, yeah, it's the airport's busy. It's much busier than it normally is. And I think it's a lot of sea air because of the Cape diversions.
We've been trying to get through quite a lot today, and we've got a great interview with DP World coming up. But Alex, anything else that's been catching your eye in air freight?
Well, the one thing that I really enjoyed seeing in Hong Kong was that Airbus is back in the market, back in the freighter market. Obviously, it's been in the passenger market. You know what? I've missed them. It's nice to have two manufacturers. One doesn't seem enough, frankly. And it was good to see them back. They've now got 50% of the large freighter market share, which is kind of astonishing, given that they've only been back for 5 minutes. So that was nice. And the other thing is that there's so many people coming up with new ideas in aviation, and that's always fun to watch. Whether they'll get off the ground is another question. But this week we covered cargo gliders, which is new to me. You drag a plane full of freight behind another plane, and apparently it cuts emissions. And there's also, someone showed me planes that can now, well, that they're designing to be able to take containers, which would be a bit of a game changer. So, yeah, there's always something happening in aviation, which is eye-catching.
And it'll all be on the lodestar.com. Peter, just as we're tying up, we've had the fourth quarter results for liners from 2023. What do you make of them? And briefly, what does this tell us about the bottom line of carriers for the rest of 2024 as we look forward?
It gives us insights into their level of costs, which comes out of the COVID years, much elevated from where we saw them enter the COVID years. So seeing more or less loss-making numbers from the carriers in the fourth quarter, of course, this is a brace for them to see the Red Sea disruptions bringing more money into their sunken chests. But then again, it is a time running out for them also with this brief lift of rates and come in later 2024, but also 2025, if we do not get a massive disruption on top of another massive disruption, then we will see rates again trend down to the critical break-even levels and probably also below that. So I think it's fair to say, as was also concluded when the releases went out, that now it's super tricky really to budget when you go out, whether you are a liner CFO or if you are a shipper CFO. Where should I set my bar for costs spent on logistics in 2024. Well, you never have a dull day in shipping, right? But I think the tide is turning now for the carriers. The massive inflow of cash is fading, and we will later this year presumably see another, say, negative EBIT margin being published from many of the carriers.
Just a final story, Peter. We've had a lot of headlines recently about security risk posed by Chinese-made cranes at US ports. Now, US lawmakers are targeting the Shanghai Containerized Freighter Index, the Shanghai Shipping Exchange. It's all the same thing, essentially, which we all use as a source of freight information. Now, legislators are claiming that it allows the Chinese government to manipulate container freight markets. If the legislation, which is called the Ocean Shipping Reform Implementation Act of 2023, if it passes the Senate, it will allow the Federal Maritime Commission to investigate the SSE and whether it's the use of the data by Chinese businesses and Chinese carriers puts US businesses and consumers at a disadvantage. Your thoughts?
I could probably not have marketed Sonetta in a better way. I mean, we're all about the crowdsourcing data, right? And having a neutral and informed decision-making process behind that. So the fact that US lawmakers now open up perhaps probe into the whereabouts of this massively watched index, this is, of course, something that we would watch very closely, because in the end, I mean, it's pretty important that we all have a mutual background to negotiate on when we sit down at the tables and want those service contracts to be dealt with in the most, well, in the best possible way, right? So let's see about it. I mean, lifting ourselves up for a brief moment, it is another geopolitical obstacle being set up. And from a wider perspective, absolutely, we expect a higher frequency of events like that to impact not only the operational level, but also at political level in the coming years.
The year of geopolitics, I think, is probably how we're going to remember 2024. Okay, in a moment, I'm going to find out a bit more about how many of these supply chain challenges we've discussed today are being handled at fast-growing DP World when I'm joined by Glenn Clark, who is the CEO for US and Mexico. But for now, Lodestar publisher Alex Linnane and Zenitor chief analyst Peter Sand, thanks for joining me today on the Lodestar podcast.
Always a pleasure, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Now, as promised, I'd like to welcome to the Lodestar podcast Glenn Clark, who is the CEO of DP World US and Mexico and regional head of contract logistics. Glenn, how are you?
Doing great, Mike. Thank you for having me on today.
You're very welcome, Glenn. Now, at the Lodestar, if we can get straight into this, we've been keeping very much on top of how US importers are reacting to all these disruptions to US ocean container shipping networks. Obviously, we have Cape diversions away from the Suez Canal, which are extending transit times into the US, especially to that East Coast. On the horizon, certainly if you're negotiating a long-term trans-Pacific shipping contract, there is also unease about the expiration on September 30th of the contract between the US Maritime Alliance and the International Longshoremen's Association, which represents 45,000 East Coast dock workers. The ILA has already threatened strikes, which may be some saber rattling, but we're not really sure. These factors seem to be pushing cargo a bit towards those West Coast gateways. So there's a lot of challenges out there at the moment. Presumably, your customers are asking your advice or for support in dealing with all this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, during TPM, that was probably one of the major points of discussion. We were fortunate to meet a number of existing and potential new customers there. I think in the middle of the day, I was going from building to building and customer meeting to customer meeting. I think 20,000 steps was recorded on my watch at one day. But the real discussion was around how is the industry preparing to navigate the significant global challenges, which are, you know, the geopolitical tensions, the armed conflicts, the trafficking, the marketing disruptions, the environmental impacts on, you know, the canals. All of that was points of discussion. And how are we helping customers solve these problems? And what options can we create to maybe head off some of this disruption?
Did you produce any solutions for those customers? What sort of solutions are people after, Glenn?
Well, yeah. I mean, for instance, the challenges that many companies are going through is how are they changing their supply chains and preparing for that stability, whether it's a shift in their in their manufacturing, a shift in where they're going to be moving products from. There's a tremendous concern that an escalation and about the tensions that are going on there. But one major takeaway, I think, from TPM is that companies are increasingly pursuing, I'll say, diversification from trans-Pacific trade. We're seeing that there's, we're watching this play out right now as major companies shift their supply chains around the globe. So what DP World and what we were able to discuss is what options can we use with using our assets, ports and terminals and stuff within Canada and within the Latin America, South America, and what contributions can we provide or solutions can we provide to handling some of that?
If I might just throw something else in there. So apart from Red Sea and ILA threats, we've also got these tensions, long-standing tensions between the US and China. They've been ramping up over the years. And there's this threat of higher tariffs. And certainly trade policy, it looks like it's going to stay front and center in the run-up to US presidential elections in November. Does this change how people view sourcing diversification? I mean, maybe in the short term, does it mean people bring in cargo early? There's a lot of things that are affected by these sort of disruptions, aren't they? Or this element of risk as we look down over the next year or so?
Yeah, I think it surely is in the discussions, right? You've got the ILA, as you said, potential implications. You've got some of the other ongoing challenges within the supply chain. But yeah, people are actually, and customers are looking at as we listen to what the voice of the customer says, we are concerned. What can we do? What options do we have? And I think that you're actually seeing many people have to be very proactive now in thinking about that. And we're in the midst of that time of the year where we're trying to negotiate contracts and get new services offered. So it's definitely impacting the business, but it's also looking, I think, from the previous lessons around COVID, we are able to find, collaboration, working with each other to find these solutions.
What sort of places are we talking about when people are looking at alternative sources of production? Obviously, we hear a lot about Mexico. We hear about Vietnam. Well, where else? I mean, you guys have got a global footprint.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've mentioned a few for sure. But I would say, India is another big place that you're seeing more and more discussions around about the impact there. I think that as we're looking at how this world shifts, and it's almost hour by hour in regards to some of the changes and what can happen. But here at DP World, when you talk about what are the customers looking for and what can we do, we're able to leverage, some of the business that we have, some of the capabilities and in India and others. We have like 6 ports in India. We have lots of warehousing. We're handling, I think, 28% of the cargo containers in India today. So that's a great example of how we're able to be in place and in a place that we can help the customers with some of their challenges.
We've seen some huge increases in volumes from China into Mexico of late, up almost 60% year on year in January in terms of container throughput. It's not yet clear exactly what is driving all this. And as we heard earlier on this podcast, but how is your business there going at the moment?
Yeah, it's going very well. And I mean, I think you're absolutely right about Mexico and the impact that the changes are having to Mexico. We're very engaged in that. And we are excited about what the opportunities are. And I think that really, this shift didn't just start with some of the most recent. It started several years ago in regards to, Mike, how we're going to diversify the supply chain, because having all the eggs in one basket's really created. So we've seen this shift. It's a growing shift. And, working with in collaboration with customers, we're able to provide solutions in Mexico. And we're also seeing that the government there is also very supportive of providing the infrastructure and building it as fast as possible to keep up with the changes that are happening in that part of the world. Yeah, I mean, there's a big shift, as you know, in Mexico. This year, Mexico actually exceeded China for the first time in regards to imports, with really Mexico, then China, and then Canada. But we're also seeing a major shift, and expect even this year, possibly, Canada to take the second role. That for us from a DP World perspective, with our Prince Rupert and our ports and the transport opportunities we have there, that's a solution that we can provide customers that some cannot. And we look at it as really a strategic play, but we also look at it as how do we help navigate through this crisis with options? And I think going back to what I said earlier, so many of the discussions that we had about what's going on in the world were customers looking for options. What can you provide? And I think that's where we really are working collaboratively with them to providing more options, more opportunities, especially with the unknown.
As you said, supply chain and investment decision planning is difficult for anyone. What sort of strategies are we seeing emerging, or what are your customers asking for help with specifically?
Well, I think it's obviously what you would expect, you know, costs, service, solutions. And, you know, at DP World, we just really announced last week the opening of over 100 freight forwarding branches. So from the perspective of what the market needs, we're able to now start offering these type of logistics solutions coupled with the investments that DP World's made into contract logistics and to market access and into the providing, I'll say, the infrastructure of the ports and terminals and economic zones. That's what we're really seeing as our shift and our focus to help provide more solutions to customers in this area.
100 freight forwarding offices, Glenn. Wow, that's quite impressive. Does this tie in with DP World's strategy of becoming more active up and down supply chains, you know, outside of the port, providing logistics answers? And if so, how do you incorporate all those new offices into a sort of North American solutions for your customers?
Yeah, well, absolutely. It is a part of the strategy. And I think that, you know, what we've really focused on is how do we become more of that end-to-end trade solution provider? And we, as an example, in US and Mexico, we had one office this time last year. We've got 14 today. And we've added these, I'll say, great people, processes, and systems to be able to navigate and help provide more solutions to customers in this really, you know, treacherous time.
And how do you intend to further expand your freight forwarding operations? What's the strategy here? And how does that impact in the Americas? Or maybe put it another way, what does scaling up look like for you?
Well, yes, we are going to continue to make investments. And, you know, for us, it is about scale. What makes freight forwarding successful is scale. The top, I'll say, areas are really around location and network and being able to provide solutions to the needs of the customer. The expansion coupled with our strategic acquisitions really has generated considerable buzz in the market. The industry is curious about how DP World's incorporation of ports and terminals and contract logistics and freight forwarding network will play out. And these initiatives will address the current and future needs of global trade. Customers are keenly interested, I think, in how DP World is transforming, looking at us, you know, not just as operators of ports and terminals, but as a comprehensive partner for their supply chain. The interest speaks volumes about our potential to influence and shape the future of global logistics and trade. I feel that, you know, many large retailers we spoke with, even that, as I said, we're launching these businesses, were interested in what DP World was doing and asking us, you know, how are we considering the combination of assets and capability for the future? So it was definitely a buzz around TPM.
Okay. So, well, where do you see your Americas operation in, say, 5 or 10 years? Are you expecting to have a significantly larger footprint? I guess what I mean is, what sort of scale are you after, given your earlier remarks on scale? Is the idea to become one of the biggest forwarders out there, backed by the infrastructure you already have?
Yeah, good question. When it comes to, you know, our vision of scale, I mean, DP World already possesses a tremendous scale with a vast network and spanning more than 189 countries. The scale is not just a number for us. It's a testament to our capability to deliver comprehensive and reliable services across the globe. Our ambition really is to leverage this scale and to achieve the same level of productivity and innovation as the leading tech giants. We aim our network to be a benchmark in our industry, synonymous with efficiency, innovation, reliability, and sustainability. Much like the tech firms use their scale to pioneer new technologies and services, we're committed to leveraging our expansive network to introduce, you know, innovative solutions. Achieving scale is not just about size. It's about enhancing every aspect of our operation, from customer service to environmental responsibility. Really, our goal is to continuously improve our offerings, ensure that they're meeting the evolving needs of our customers and stay ahead of the industry trends.
This sounds like my scoop here, Glenn. So what you're saying to me really is you want more scale, or at least scale might not be just about size, but you are going to be expanding. So that means more acquisition, surely.
You know, we just recently announced in the Americas back in late October, early November, the acquisition of CFR Rankins, because it was a very much a strategic fit with the vertical of automotive solutions. And it's focusing its capability on finished goods. So there was a good fit there. And so we're definitely looking at how we can find niche players in the area that would support the overall strategy of the business and help us to grow what the customer demand is. Right now, from a finished vehicle perspective in the U.S., between Mexico, Canada, and the U.S., there's a lot of pent-up business sitting there because there's not enough opportunities to move vehicles. So they're looking for alternatives, which we felt like was a good niche fit for our business.
So watch this M&A space then. I think I'll conclude with Glenn Clark, CEO of DP World US and Mexico. Thanks for joining me today on the Loadstar podcast.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate the time.
Big thanks to DP World for supporting the Loadstar's independent journalism. A shout out to my editing team of Tom Matthews and Karen Ball. And gratitude to you all for listening. We'll be back soon.